This is the big crisis of the 21st century. We've arrived.
I mean, in a way, Martin, you've sort of been vindicated. You haven't had your crash, but you've had a certain kind of collapse of the economic system, haven't you?
Well, it is. This was going to happen anyway. Definitely, because they had 12 years since 2008 to reform the financial sector, and they didn't do anything.
Well, and as Mervyn King pointed out, we had a $166 trillion debt overhang that could never be paid.
Yes, and they just carried on. They carried on just subbing people money to carry on doing what they were doing, and that was going to crash. Now that's why you've got you talk about means, motive, and opportunity in any criminal enterprise. They've got a motive to do this because it was going to crash anyway. But if it crashes because of COVID-19, then you've got all sorts of policy. You've got a cover story about why it crashed. You've got the people locked down so that they can't protest about whatever measures you want to take. And so on. So that is a plausible scenario for what we're looking at here, because it was going to crash anyway. Before this COVID-19 crisis broke, the stock markets of the world were the highest they'd ever been, but they were wobbling, really wobbling, because they're only basically high on monetary heroin, which is basically, quantitative easing. And isn't it extraordinary that the right-wing governments in both US and Britain have suddenly decided they can nationalise everything with the magic money tree, which they could have always done in the first place, but now they're doing it.
Okay, so we're going to talk about a bit more of speculation in a minute, but Martin, first of all, we have the anniversary of the horrific Christchurch mosque massacre here in New Zealand. Actually, it was in Christchurch. But there's a Royal Commission looking into it, which is taking place behind closed doors. Not only that, the trial is secret. And also, the gunman has pleaded guilty just today. And therefore, there really will be no scrutiny of anything. And some of the things that I've been digging out, I had a chat to an author who's written a book. He's based down in Tauranga, and he's written a book about the massacre, which includes, he calls it the Christchurch Mosque Massacre, Satanism and John Podesta. And it might sound a bit strange to use Satanism in the title, but the reason he's done that is because of this thing called the Black Sun, which was on the front of his manifesto, which is banned here in New Zealand, which is a satanic symbol, and no one really doubts that. But the interesting thing was that he also includes John Podesta in the title, because John Podesta was here in New Zealand just a couple of days before the massacre took place. Now, can you just give us an idea of who Podesta is, Martin? I know he's very closely associated with the sort of financing and tactics behind the Hillary Clinton's electoral campaign.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know that much about him, but he's definitely an insider in the deep state in the United States of America. And it's very interesting that from what I remember about this shooter, is that he'd been around in Europe, he'd been in places like Bosnia and places like this, and he looks like somebody who's, he comes from that demi-monde. And, obviously I'm always suspicious about these kind of attacks.
What makes me more suspicious is the secrecy under which the so-called investigations are going on, a completely secret Royal Commission and a completely secret trial. 51 people died a year ago, and also three were arrested, suspects. Two were then released. Now, eyewitnesses at the second mosque say that it would be totally impossible for the shooter to get from the first mosque to the second mosque and then be arrested afterwards in another place, that it was simply impossible for him to do it, even if he was just driving from one to the other to the other and not shooting anybody. So it does look as if there are two shooters at the second mosque have managed to somehow get away, wriggle out of it, that he couldn't possibly have done all that. But there was also quite incredible the way that the manifesto has been banned here in New Zealand. And also the video, the live streamed video, has also been banned, even apparently to journalists to watch. And I've had a look at it, and I've taken three stills from it. I mean, it's a pretty harrowing thing to watch, obviously. I wouldn't expect anyone to actually want to watch it, but, it's part of my job. And I've taken three stills from that original video, and it's quite clear that there are three people at important waypoints in the attack on the mosque dressed in red. One is where the shooter is parked by the side of the road with his music playing in his car and his left window down. A red figure walks past, and as just after the red figure on the pavement on the left of the car has walked past the open window, we don't actually see them as they're right next to the car, but we see them as they're walking towards it, and we see the windows open. The car then starts moving forward and the attack begins. And the next red figure is at the point where the vehicle turns left into the alleyway with the mosque at the end of it. There's another red figure there that stood in the alleyway. As the car arrives, the red figure turns and then walks back down the road, almost as if to say, it looks as if, honestly, it looks as if the person is saying, right, it's okay to come in here now. And then there's another red figure against the wall of the mosque, which you see on the shooter's webcam just as he's pulling out of the mosque. Now, the guy that's written this book has told me that he's spoken to US Navy SEALs, and he says this is standard operating procedure for a military attack, a military operation.
Yep.
And also that the use of the strobe light on the video is also a standard military procedure by gunmen, an army operation to kill people. They use the strobe light to disorientate people. So there's not a lot coming out about this attack, and Martin, and the main evidence, the guy's manifesto and the video, is totally banned in the country.
Well, I mean, it reminds me a lot of the attack on Utøya in Norway, where a lone gunman apparently killed several people with bombs, got in a car, drove to an island off the coast where there was a, as you know, a Labour Party Young Socialist camp, and manages to kill 60, 70 people without being stopped. It just beggars belief. And a lot of these attacks we know are orchestrated from inside the intelligence services. The 9/11.
The other thing, of course, is it also is a bit like the 7/7 attacks in London, Martin. It also makes the terror real. I mean, this is something people have been seeing on TV in New Zealand. We had been seeing it on the TV
and reading about it
in our newspapers in Britain. But an attack like this turns it into a reality.
Well, what you've got in Norway and New Zealand is a relatively progressive socialist societies, successful socialist societies. They're outside the mainstream. They've got, you know, some of the best, highest standards of living in the world, the most equal communities. And those kind of societies have got to be blooded. You're not allowed to have a successful non-capitalist philosophy in the world today. It's just you're not going to be allowed to do it. The
trial taking place in secret, I find absolutely shocking, because obviously this needs to be, and also now in pleading guilty, there will be virtually no evidence coming out at the trial. This is extremely dodgy. When you also compare it to, there was a mass murder case, and a police corruption case, which was uncovered and the guy released from prison here. Then he was accused by a woman or two women of historic sexual abuse, and he's been rearrested. I believe he may be out on bail. I'm not sure of the names of these people. But there's another guy who was the father of someone that died at the Pike River mine accident, which people may remember a few years ago. I think it was in Greymouth or near Greymouth on the South Island. Yeah, sorry to just get obsessed with the New Zealand news for a minute, but it is fascinating to see the way that the justice system has been compromised here. The father of one of the victims in this mine disaster, if people remember, there was a collapse or explosion inside a mine, a coal mine, and the emergency services decided not to go in, were told not to go in, and this was very controversial at the time. And one of the fathers of one of the victims has been very outspoken, and he's now been arrested with historic, again, accusations of sexual misconduct, which is hardly been reported here, but it's pretty shocking to see that people could potentially be targeted in this way, literally by accusations by, and this is the really incredible bit, is we're not even allowed to know the names or identities or anything of those who've made these accusations that have put people like this in prison.
Yeah, well, New Zealand is one of the Five Eyes countries, so which is the so-called the former echelon network for spying on the world. So although Norway, of course, is part of NATO. So although they've got kind of an internal liberal political regime, the external relations of these two small countries are dominated by major powers, the US basically with the Britain. And that's what's going on. We know from a fact, from going back years, that the strategy of tension is the basic modus operandi of Western intelligence services. So you have Muslim extremists killing people, you've got right-wing extremists killing people, you've got just random attacks, and of course things like pandemics and so on, all of which then force the population into a position where they feel that they have to support established authority because they feel threatened, they feel scared, they lack all security. And of course, this is a conscious strategy. It's a war-fighting strategy.
I mean, let's just go back for a minute to last Easter and the horrific attack on the churches or the church in Sri Lanka. I mean, it did transpire, didn't it, I think it was the Saudi Arabians had sent messages to their consulate or embassy in Sri Lanka. Warning of this attack, saying something like this is going to happen, make sure you don't go anywhere near these places. Now, I mean, it was supposed to be a surprise attack, and yet somehow the Saudis knew it was happening.
Yeah, well, it's not a surprise to those who are carrying it out, is it? And that's the truth of the matter. And of course, there are relatives of people who died in the 9/11 attacks who are trying to sue the Saudi Arabian government for complicity in the 9/11 attack. And of course, I think the Saudis were complicit. But I also think the US military were complicit, and so were the Israelis, because their agents were captured at the scene and then went back to Israel and were on TV. The fact is, since we know that they engage in all of this kind of skullduggery, we're bound to ask the question when something like COVID-19 comes along, is this another one of those? And even if it's just something that happened naturally, they immediately batten on to natural disasters in any case, to try and push their agenda. So after Hurricane Katrina wasted all the poor community in the downtown New Orleans, they got rid of all those people, and it's now been redeveloped as luxury housing.
Okay, so let's go back to looking at some more speculation, really, to do with the coronavirus, and that is the role of these sort of what get called by various people, John Kulak in the US is one of them, and there's lots of others that talk about the paperclip Nazis, that there is this kind of faction in the United States which was brought over after World War II to fight the Soviet Union. I mean, that these were many war criminals, and there's quite a faction over there, and that there may be some sort of fight going on within the US deep state between a kind of Nazi faction and people who are just simply in the intelligence services and trying to do their job.
Well, I think what you've got, in fact, is there is a faction which is made up of people who were former fascist intelligence operatives. But at the same time, you've got people that have got that sort of mentality in any case in the infrastructure in the West.
Well, it's not these same individual people, because they'd be dead by now, but people with a kind of similar mindset.
So the whole idea of psychological warfare, the idea that by pulling strings behind the scenes, you can get big results, and you can manipulate elections, you can assassinate individuals that you don't like, you can make populations terrified so that they demand measures to be taken to give the state more power. We know for a fact that this has been going on for years. So when something like this comes along, we're inevitably going to ask the question, is this another version of that? And I'm afraid all the evidence tends to suggest it is. And it's not surprising that the Chinese and the Iranian military have already said, we're not happy with your explanation of this. And the Russians have pretty much said the same. We don't believe a word you say. And of course, they've got every reason to say that. It's not as if they just, from sheer bloody mindedness, have decided they're not going to listen to the reasonable prognostications of the likes of Pompeo.
I mean, getting back to the virus. Getting back to the virus, there is a tension actually between some medical opinion which talks about vaccination as being the right answer, a kind of wonder injection, and others that talk about herd immunity. And medical debate doesn't seem to have been had, and that seems to be like dividing people quite a lot. Do you think it's fair to say that people should be able to choose whether they get vaccinated or not? In the old days, we certainly used to talk about something called informed consent. So doctors, you know, basically just do use informed consent on people. People can say if they don't want to be treated or not, and that seems to potentially If they move towards mandatory vaccination, which certainly Germany definitely seems to be doing. In fact, I met a German tourist who was very much pro-mandatory vaccination and said to him, well, you know, if you're going to mandatory vaccinate me, then we're going to have to fight about that because I'm not going to be mandatory vaccinated. And he said, oh, that is selfish. Well, no, hang on. So there's a debate potentially, you know, rolling out here between this medical arguments for herd immunity and vaccination.
Well, herd immunity, let's face it, that's just silly. This is a novel virus. So,
so I see which side of the debate you're on. But no, there is definitely some evidence that works. Human populations do develop, eventually develop an immunity to these things.
No, listen. The term herd immunity only functions when you've actually got a vaccinated population. When you've got a novel virus, you can't rely on herd immunity. You just can't, because you don't know what it's going to do. Yeah. So that's why the British line of we're going to develop herd immunity collapsed in about a week. And then they actually, because nobody else is approaching it like that. So that's just off the table. Now, vaccines, if you're going to vaccinate people, you've got to show that this vaccine has been developed without any private profit being made from it, for example. So that
isn't it, in the modern world?
Well, it's impossible under our system. It's not impossible in other parts of the world where the healthcare system, like in Cuba, is not based on making any private profits for anybody. And in actual fact, that's what makes their system superior. So we've got all of these questions about how you actually deal with genuine threats, if there is a genuine threat. And then beyond that, you've got the actual fact that we may be dealing with what is a bio-psycho-warfare attack. So it's basically an attack on people's minds so that you can achieve certain political objectives. Now, I'm certainly not convinced either way yet. We've got to keep an open mind about it. But the idea that this is some kind of come on by the bad people is absolutely logical and rational. And anybody who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about.
What do you think about the, we've seen in China now, it's become a criminal offence to eat wild meat. That is to say, you know, if you find, say, for example, a roadkill pheasant, if they exist, I suppose they do in China actually, and you take it home and you eat it, you will be, anyone from the authorities finds out, as they tend to do in China, you'll go to jail potentially for eating wild meat. Now, this is also a way, of course, of forcing people to go. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of people here in New Zealand who eat quite a lot of their food, either get fish or go hunting to get their food. Pig hunting's a big thing here in Coromandel. So that does seem to be a very draconian measure, it seems to me. And they think that the wild food is a way of spreading this virus. But it's also, of course, a way of surviving in a financial collapse.
Well, it is. But you know, you've got people doing eating bushmeat in Africa. But it's devastating for the wildlife, and they do it because they haven't got any access to any sort of protein. The real economic effects of this are going to, well, let's, for example, just do a little thought experiment. What if the Chinese capitalist economy collapses here? Because capitalist economies do, yeah? They've got a massive property bubble in Shanghai and all the rest of it, same as in...
But banks can always make up more money, Martin.
Well, yes, well, that's what they've, and they've got state-owned banks in China, so they can intervene more aggressively than in the West. But nevertheless, the problem about any capitalist system is it's based on boom and bust is real. And when bust comes, what are you going to do? Some people are going to eat bats, some people are going to take a gun and shoot the people who are eating bats, then the people who are eating bats might take guns and shoot them back, or they might organise themselves into militias of one kind or another. This is going to be a test of the social and political structures of the whole of human society. It's just horrendous. And the consequences are going to be pretty bad, whichever way it plays out. I can't see good consequences from this coming anytime soon.
What we've seen in Israel, of course, is a corruption charge against the Prime Minister, who's now leading the charge against coronavirus. So he's the guy, Netanyahu, who's in charge of dealing with coronavirus, but he's was being tried for corruption. Also, of course, in France, Macron was facing possibly the end of his presidency through mass protests. Now the boot is on the other foot. The yellow vests have been told if you come out on the street, you're going to be arrested.
Well, yes, and that's bound to create suspicion, isn't it? Now, let's presume, for the sake of argument, this is a natural event, that there isn't actually any more sinister aspect to it. But even if it is just a natural event, you can see the temptation for political leaders to use this event, this series of events, to achieve various objectives that they had already in their minds. That's basically the thesis of Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. She doesn't say that they deliberately create the disasters, but they, as soon as a disaster happens, they batten on it like vultures, you know, vultures eating.
They haven't really been talking about police state or state of emergency. What we've heard here in New Zealand is that the government doesn't want to use these terms because they might cause panic, but actually that is what's in place.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm in two minds as reasonable people should be about this, because in many ways, the unselfish behaviour of Cuban doctors as they go in to try and deal with pandemics and epidemics in the developing world is absolutely exemplary. But that implies that you've got to have some kind of, you know, controlling public officials in charge of it all. The West isn't run like that. I mean, basically, the West is, I mean, did you see the people that Trump had with him on his press conferences? It's not mostly medical people. It's the heads of big corporations. Amazon and Google and all these other people are there with him saying that we're going to fight this virus together. But they're basically private organizations with a private agenda.
Well, maybe one of the purposes of this legislation, and the particular the lockdown as a reaction to the virus, is to squash all of their competition.
Well, yes, and of course, if you know what you're doing, you can benefit from any from a disaster. You just have to be in the right place at the right time. And there was going to be a crash anyway. The COVID-19 aspect of the crash means that it's been very, very severe and very quick. But it was going to happen anyway, and it provides a perfect cover for governments to then. I mean, basically, Wall Street has just been given another paycheck from the taxpayers in the US. And then nobody's paying any attention because everybody's worried about.
But it'll be interesting to see if any of that filters down to ordinary people. Look, okay, so the question is, I suppose, now that we're not allowed to meet except, I suppose, on some sort of internet chat place, is dissent possible? Is it a good idea for dissenters, for political meetings to take place, for the potentially government measures to be questioned, criticised by the population?
Well, I think a key thing for me is we need to get testing doing so that we've got some idea of how many people actually got the virus and whether it actually leads automatically to bad. You know, some people might get the virus and have no symptoms. Again, that could be an aspect of it as a biowarfare weapon. But why aren't we testing? In South Korea, they've been testing to try and work out who the hell's got it. Because if you can work out who's got it, then the people who haven't got it can get on with their business.
Well, I mean, maybe the impetus on the government not to test is because they might find...
Rather less. You see what I mean? Either way, rather less, yes.
It could be, also, could be, Martin, finally, what's your... would you like to speculate on how long these extreme measures will be in place? We're told here 4 weeks. You've got 3 weeks, but it may well be longer.
The hope is that if we really go for it straight away with a big... lockdown.
But when you say go for it, that means they're trying to flatten the curve. That's the point, isn't it?
They don't want the hospitals to be overrun. I mean, the London hospitals are basically saying today we're being overwhelmed. Yeah. So that's what you don't want. And of course, that then leads a knock-on effect of all these other people who actually need healthcare can't get to a hospital or a doctor because they're overwhelmed with the coronavirus. So they start dying. Then, of course, people start losing their jobs and get put. Then they get kicked out of their houses. Because they can't pay the rent. How can you self-isolate if you're just being evicted? That's the danger. And of course, all of these things then come to a head in the United States where everybody's got automatic weapons.
That's one thing we've seen here in New Zealand is a big increase in queues at the gun shops before they were closed. I suppose what we're seeing really is a division of people from healthy scepticism, obviously obeying the sensible rules to stop spreading any kind of contamination, and those who are militantly obedient. What we've seen certainly here is a sort of rise in the little Hitlers, people who are shouting at you. And Jacinda, the Prime Minister here, has said, look, be kind, you know, there's no need to be a little Hitler. She hasn't said that, that's me.
Well, I think what you're finding here in Bristol, I've been going out every day, is there's definitely a sort of wary camaraderie developing. You know, people that wouldn't normally talk to you are talking to you. Yeah. But at the same time, people are clearly fearful. And, you know, you're seeing some of the best in people's human behavior. And also you're seeing people behaving rather badly as they just try and look after number one and don't think of anybody else. But I mean, that's what you'd expect to find.
What it's done for me anyway is it's shown me the value of face-to-face contact. And that's the one thing we're being told in some ways, certainly by, you know, people on the radio, you're not allowed to go out. Well, that's just simply not the case.
Yeah, well, I think we are going out here in Bristol, but people are keeping a fairly
safe. I mean, obviously, it makes sense for elderly people not to, potentially, but, yeah. You know, you are allowed to go out. And I think the face-to-face stuff seems to me to be, in a way, a bit like what happened in the Arab Spring in Egypt, in Cairo, when they switched the internet off, everybody went out and started organising protests and stuff.
You can see that you can't, because of the nature of this situation, that's not going to be so straightforward, is it? And that raises questions, doesn't it? But I mean, we shall see what's the effects of this are going to carry on for decades. Yeah. Whatever happens now, this is the big inflection point. And, we're going to be living with the consequences of this for the rest of our lives, all of us.
Time to sign off now for the USA and Comcast News at 11 for the BCFM broadcast of this podcast and on Monday evening. Thanks to our guests, David Halpin and Nigel Day from Oxford CND. Also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM week. I'll be back in the UK in April, God willing. Do please join us on the BCFM emergency schedule dialect politics show online on Friday or on FM at 10 p.m. Monday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. We'll be right back.